Good evening and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Evening Lecture Series, the first of the fall 2024 semester. Thank you for spending your Friday evening with us for a wonderful talk that we're going to have tonight. I'm Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator of the Institute, and tonight we have with us Professor Manu Bagnalan from Hunter College, who will be speaking about his latest book, Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit, a biography published by Penguin last year, and is based on 8 years of research and using a material in 5 languages from 7 countries and 40 archives. Manu Bagnalan is a renowned historian specializing in modern India, particularly the late colonial and post-colonial periods. His research interests lie in human rights, internationalism, and questions of sovereignty. He currently holds the prestigious position of Professor of History, Human Rights, and Public Policy at Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Additionally, he serves as a senior fellow at the Ralph Bunch Institute for International Studies. Professor Bagnalan is a prolific author with a distinguished body of work. His past publications include The Peacemakers, as well as India and the Quest for One World, critically acclaimed international history exploring India's quest for a world free from conflict. In addition to his academic contributions, he's also a highly sought-after commentator on contemporary issues. His work has appeared in prestigious publications such as the New York Times and Time Magazine, and he is featured prominently on news channels, including CNN and NPR. Please welcome Professor Bagnalan.
Thank you, Anthony, for that introduction, and good evening, friends, students, and faculty, and thank you for coming. I am honored to be speaking with you here at the Asian American Asian Research Institute about my new biography of Vijayalakshmi Pandit. I'm very glad to be able to partner with Ari once more, recalling fond memories of time I spent with Dr. Thomas Tam many years ago when we had the opportunity to work together on a CUNY-wide human rights event. I'm so glad to see Ari, now under the capable leadership of my friend John Chin, and Anthony Wong, as well as others like Sonia Munshi, and my old classmate and friend, Linta Varghese. And I would like to thank them for inviting me here today, and especially Anthony for all of his organizational efforts. I'd also like to take a moment to recognize and thank all of Ari's support staff, as well as the broader sanitation and security crew in the building for looking after all of us this evening. Seated on a dais, two figures lean into one another. At camera right sits Mahatma Gandhi, bespeckled, Spartan in his loincloth, holding some sheaves of paper. On the left is his protege and formal successor, Jawaharlal Nehru. Debonair in his starched white shirt and cap, and homespun coarse cotton vest with mandarin collar, he holds a pair of half-folded glasses. The faces of both men are relaxed as they share an intimate moment, a private quip, their heads ever so tilted towards one another. They laugh. This picture was captured by renowned Associated Press photographer Max Desfer at the All India Congress Committee meeting in Bombay on the 6th of July, 1946. This multi-layered image spoke so much about these two men, their charisma, their shared chemistry, their close bond, their mutual admiration, their different personal choices. And it also captured the idea of the new India about to be made free from a long period of colonial rule. It caught people's imagination and became a defining photograph. So I was stunned a few years ago to find that the original was framed so differently. In this, the camera takes a much wider angle. The V between the two tilting heads is now not the center of the image at all, but rather off to the top right. Nehru sits in the middle of the image, and to his left is Vijayalakshmi Pandit. Radiant in an all-white homespun sari with a sleeveless blouse, she glances off to the side with a knowing smirk on her face. There were three who were part of that moment, but she was sliced right out of it, erased from the public memory of that moment, and thus from the history of it altogether. I have reflected on this photograph and its reproduction over several years, using the original for the cover of my previous book, The Peacemakers. All three of the figures were important to my narrative, but it was Nehru who was at the center of it. The photo captured this perfectly. When Max Desfort passed away at 104 in 2019, the AP featured the original photograph, this one, the one that included Madame Pandit, as she was widely known, in the obituary carried by newspapers all over the world. The true story was now there for all to see. But Vijayalakshmi Pandit's previous excision was not accidental. It was, rather, a purposeful act of exclusion, a knowing omission that purged her from the narrative and part of a much more systemic deletion of women from the realms of achievement and action. As I looked into this a bit more, I soon discovered that Madame Pandit and her life seemed to hold many secrets. The story is quite a bit different than what we know. There's another version of that Desfort photograph taken by someone else that I've only once had a glimpse of. This is a real photo. In this version, Nehru is slanted more towards his sister. She is leaning in. Her face is wide and bright, and she is looking directly at her brother and the Mahatma. Her mouth is open in a toothy grin. And there's a new possibility. She isn't simply amusedly listening in. She's telling the joke. This episode marks the point of departure for my lecture today, both for how it began and the study on which it's based, both in how it began and ultimately in terms of what it has proved to be about. Several years ago, a colleague of mine stopped by my office to offer me a copy of a book he had just published on the United States and world affairs. He thought this would be of particular interest to me because it featured Madame Pandit. I was embarrassed to realize, once I figured out that he meant Vijayalakshmi Pandit, that I did not know anything about her, other than the fact that she was Nehru's sister. The embarrassment prompted me to look into it further, and I soon discovered that there was simply not at all that much written about her. She was not much more than a footnote in most accounts, just as reflected in the edited version of Desfort's photograph. Yet my colleague's book suggested that there was more to it. This set me on a journey that eventually resulted in my book, The Peacemakers. As I wrote it, I was struck by her big personality and rather wondrous accomplishments. She seemed to leap right out of the page whenever she appeared. Years later, when I was in the middle of a new and entirely different project, I found my mind regularly wandering back to her story. I felt I was missing something, that I had only scratched the surface and that something much larger was waiting for me. I shared this with my wife one day and added that what I really wanted to do was to write Vijayalakshmi Pandit's biography for Penguin. She nodded in sympathy and told me to get back to work. A few weeks later, I received a message from an editor at Penguin inviting me to write this very book. I took this as a cosmic sign, and here we are. So this is how I came to write about Vijayalakshmi Pandit. But who exactly was she? The first woman cabinet minister in the British Empire to hold substantial portfolios, president of the All India Women's Conference, India's first ambassador to the United Nations, India's first ambassador to the Soviet Union, member of India's Constituent Assembly, the first woman ambassador to the United States, the first woman president of the UN General Assembly, High Commissioner to the United Kingdom and Ireland, additional appointments to Spain and Mexico, elected Member of Parliament. Fascinating. But this, of course, is but a list of titles. And while they immediately underscore the pioneering nature of her work, they do not, in fact, tell us much about who she was. What exactly did she do? Answering this question is where things get interesting and, in a sense, overwhelming. For she seemed to be involved with everything, everywhere, all at once. For instance, she had audiences with British royalty right from a young age and grew quite close to members of the British aristocracy, even as she challenged the might of the British Empire alongside Mahatma Gandhi and went to prison for it several times. She was detained for the attempted assassination of Mussolini in the 1920s. She stayed next door to Lord Runciman, Britain's lead negotiator in Czechoslovakia, during the Sudeten crisis. She was outside 10 Downing Street when Chamberlain declared peace for our time. To headlines, she bashed appeasement and warned of the dangers of fascism in Britain the day before Winston Churchill made his famous remarks to Parliament. She worked with Margaret Sanger, Alexandra Kollontai, Golda Meir, and Madame Chang at various times. Raphael Lemkin turned to her for help in establishing the Genocide Convention. She engaged with everyone from Mao Zedong and Charles de Gaulle to Francisco Franco, Konrad Adenauer, Kwame Nkrumah. W.E.B. Du Bois heralded her as the leader of the successful assault against the color line. She showed up for Judge Dorothy Kenyon, when the American judge and the inspiration to Ruth Bader Ginsburg was targeted by Joseph McCarthy. Marlon Brando named her the woman he admired most in the world. Robert Oppenheimer asked her for assistance in preventing nuclear disaster. She told Kennedy not to go to Dallas. And the list goes on. But with this rudimentary understanding of the magnitude of her reach, I would like to focus the remainder of my time with some readings from my book that I hope will illustrate her major contributions to intellectual thought and international affairs. As one of India's best-known faces abroad for many decades, she wielded considerable influence with plenty of latitude to act according to her own judgment. Even so, she held positions and was an emissary of her government, and thus whatever she said or did had to broadly fit into their policies. And from independence, she had to follow the parameters set by the foreign minister and the prime minister, both in this case being the same person, her brother Jawaharlal Nehru. So whatever positions she embraced and advocated, with one major exception, which I'll return to later, they all must be seen as part of the overall foreign policy framework of India. But how exactly did that framework emerge? Pundit was a prolific writer, but her book-length works were experiential in nature. What happened while she was a minister, her days in prison during the 1940s, and memoir of the broad sweep of her life. She did not write treatises on foreign policy, international relations, or philosophy, but she did write many letters and speeches on these subjects, enough to fill volumes, I know because I went through them all, and therein, in various ways, large and small, explicated a meaningful and coherent worldview, independently evolved, eclectic, and cosmopolitan. At times, this put her at odds with Gandhi and Nehru, though in dialogical rather than oppositional terms. The takeaway is that Vijayalakshmi Pandit, in heretofore largely unacknowledged ways, played a role in the world of ideas as much as in the world of action. That is, much as we can now see that women's historic unpaid labor in the home was nonetheless work that contributed to the financial well-being of the family, letters, conversations, and the like must be seen as critical contributions to the larger narrative. Jawaharlal Nehru is often credited with shaping independent India's ideas and for providing the most detailed understanding of international affairs in his country, often in deeply insightful and lengthy books. While this remains true, I think Vijayalakshmi Pandit's contributions, and indeed those of many women, have simply not been properly acknowledged nor fully explored, on account of both their gender and, in part derivative of that, the manner and fora in which they express their ideas. Many pioneering scholars have been trying to tell us this for decades. I hope my work, possible only on account of the insistent voices that have come before, will lend itself to a louder correction of such absences. Now, I want to highlight three distinct moments from her career in the following readings. The first moment is from 1941 to 1942, during World War II, before the creation of the interim government, which was the transitionary government before independence. The second is immediately after, in late 1946, and the third and final moment comes from the mid-1950s during her tenure in London. For these moments, I'm going to read excerpts from the biography. For coherency and conciseness, these passages have been edited together from much lengthier ones. In between each, I'll offer brief contextualizing commentary to help us see the three points in time in one frame. Now the readings. Moment one. She was known by a shorthand, Nan, That's the term I use to refer to her throughout the narrative. All her friends and family called her that, and she was called Nan because her British nanny, when she was very, very young, could not pronounce Nani, which is what she was called, and so it just became Nan. Nan's disappointment at having to shelve her China plans for the time being was tempered by some other news that arrived at just the same moment. She had been elected the president of the 16th session of the All India Women's Conference. A few days after Nan was named to her new position of leadership, a group of prominent British women who considered themselves Friends of India, feminists, and activists in the cause of peace, delivered an open message to the women of India, stressing British friendliness, urging them to realize India's peril from the Axis, and pleading with them to embrace the war effort. This is World War II. To embrace the war effort fully. Several of these writers were the same ones who had earlier criticized the British government over their arrest of Nan. She's been arrested several times by this point. These women included Dame Elizabeth Cadbury of chocolate fame and Grace Lancaster. But this was a broader group that included the likes of Lady Violet Bonham Carter, the daughter of a former British Prime Minister and close companion of current PM Winston Churchill, and later grandmother of celebrated Hollywood actress Helena. This is the British women. Quote, we know how passionately you hate war. We hate war too, they wrote, saying it was a terrible indictment of their generation that brute force was used as an instrument of policy. Nonetheless, they felt the Axis were an existential threat that had to be fought, and they warned of what was to come to the subcontinent if the Allies did not soon prevail. This is them again. We are told that some of you say that this is the war of British imperialism, and that therefore Indian nationalists can have no part in it, they wrote with disbelief. They quoted a recent FDR broadcast that the whole world stood divided between human slavery and freedom and begged India to set aside political differences for the moment and join the fight for the side they knew it stood for. Without victory for the democracies, there can be no Indian freedom. And we assure you in all sincerity that never was there so much sympathy with Indian aspirations as to be found in Britain today, they ended. Though the letter may have been well-intentioned, it was not well-received in India. Many took umbrage with the writer's ignorance of ground realities. Nan, for her part, was outraged and dashed off a reply straight off without thinking of its suitability. Right after posting it, Nan was contacted by one of the other officials within the All India Women's Conference, who asked if she would sign on to a joint statement critiquing the British Women's Appeal. A number of prominent Indian women and a few other leaders of the AIWC had also asked to co-sign. Nan thought that their overall response, the one she was being asked to co-sign, was, quote, milk and water, especially when compared to her own, but added her name in any event. They wrote, they said, in their individual capacities, but also as representatives of the Women's Conference and of the conviction of a large body of India's women. They called out the white privilege, condescension, and willful blindness they saw in the open message. India was already fighting on behalf of the West, so such a plaintive plea was really just cover for the further denial of Indian self-determination. Prime Minister Churchill, Nan and the others pointed out, had no misgivings about the status that India occupies in the British mind. It is a dependency which can be and is being utilized at the British will. He knows that he does not need the consent or cooperation of India's thinking sons and daughters in anything that Britain wants for fighting the war. The British used Indian soldiers as well as taxation and so-called voluntary contributions to claim any amount of money they wished. The fact is, the AIWC team wrote bluntly, you are wholly wrong in your estimate of things. You quote today that the whole world is divided between human slavery and human freedom. The fact is that there is no such thing as human freedom for the Asiatic races, certainly not for India, nor is there any for the Africans. The result, whatever it may be, of the war will not alter their condition for the better, save through their own efforts. As we see the realities, it is this. It is a war between the British Empire and the Nazis and fascists for world domination, meaning in effect the exploitation of the non-European races. We cannot be in love with Nazism and fascism, but we may not be expected to be in love with British imperialism either. For context, it is important to note that Vijayalakshmi Pandit and her brother had consistently called out the threat posed by fascism from the late 1930s and preceding Winston Churchill. It was the sanctimoniousness of the British appeal the Indian women found most irksome. Lastly, they wrote, "Let us point out the anomaly of British women asking India, though a slave nation, to help a slave owner in distress, instead of asking the slave owner to undo the wrong and cure himself of the initial sin and thus ensure the moral justness of his position. This presentation of the picture may appear unpleasant to you, but it is nonetheless sincere, and we could not answer your sincerity except by being equally sincere," they wrote. The independently crafted response was published first, followed several days later by the collective petition. Nan received letters of congratulation from different parts of India for her efforts. So we're going to flash forward just a bit. The 16th session of the All India Women's Conference was held several months later in late December 1941 in the southern coastal city of Kolkata. Nan's keynote address, delivered shortly after her initial comments from welcoming officials, drew connections to women around the world and to organizations fighting for interrelated causes. "The great forces arising in the world today will ultimately help shape the new world which will come into being after the war. It is in planning for a new world order that women should take their share. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom has declared itself in favor of a world order based on a new attitude of man to man and nation to nation, with the realization of interdependence and a renunciation of exploitation and profiteering. But declarations, to be effective, must be implemented by action." She continued, "We must decide whether we shall ally ourselves to the forces of life or those of death. Shall we raise our united voice in favor of a brave new world where human life and human liberty receive the respect which is their due, where progress and security are within the grasp of each individual? The future, not for women only, but for humanity as well, is what the women of India make of it. Today, woman faces the world as an individual for the first time. Her problems are the problems of society, and while fighting for those legal, civic, and economic rights, which are still denied to us, let us not forget that the whole question of rights for women is closely linked to the social question, which in turn is part of the larger political question." By way of ending, she first praised efforts to codify the Hindu law of succession, which sought to address deficiencies in the way women inherited property. She noted that the codification of the whole of Hindu law was urgently required based on the equality of status between man and woman. Then she closed by appealing to her friends to remove the hatred and suspicion which have crept into our midst. "India belongs to all of us," she reminded them. "Her greatness is the result of that culture to which each sect and religion has contributed. Her past glory as well as her present fallen condition are the handiwork of her children. Some of the work we have done may have value, but if we can contribute even a small measure to the unity of India, we shall not have lived in vain." So that's moment one. There are several key points we might want to glean from this. First, Vijayalakshmi Pandit had a notion of rights that included the civil and political as well as the economic and social, a totalizing conception that ultimately would serve as the basis of India's external views, which in turn shaped the official United Nations organs it helped craft. She does not explicitly use the term human rights here, but it is clearly what is meant. The rest of her vision for the world included global interdependence and collective security, while nonetheless foregrounding anti-imperialism and anti-racism. It is also worth noting that while she spoke individually and of individualism, she worked collaboratively with other women in the AIWC, also fashioning collective responses. We can thus see illustrated here the core values and principles of the concept of one world, which was a foreign policy objective of India, and basically stood for a world federal government. And the other parameters of Indian foreign policy well before either her brother or Wendell Willkie, the American vice presidential, the American presidential candidate who wound up working for FDR, Republican presidential candidate who ended up working for FDR, or Wendell Willkie, 1942 to 1943, had formalized them. Okay, now the second moment takes place in New York in the latter half of 1946, when Vijayalakshmi Pandit challenged South Africa for its racist laws as the head of India's delegation to the new United Nations. This was her second trip stateside, and on her previous visit, she had led the counter-delegation to the United Nations Organization Conference in San Francisco, working then with W.E.B. Du Bois and the NAACP. In that trip, in 1945, she had articulated a vision of what the UN should be. It was in this trip in 1946 that she turned it into what it would be, and this part here, what I'm about to do, the reason why I spent some time on that India stuff will become apparent in just one second. Okay, moment two, and now we're in New York. Nan landed at LaGuardia Field to clear skies and pleasant fall weather early in the day in mid-October. Just before her departure, she had broadcast her analysis of the South African situation and its ramifications and foreshadowed the case she hoped to make in New York. Little more than a year ago, the Organization of the United Nations came into existence, she said, to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small. And the world, grown weary with much bloodshed and suffering, turned hopeful eyes towards this new organization. She began this citing the preamble to the United Nations Charter. Today, she went on, fundamental rights so recently promised to the peoples of the world are being denied to Indians living in South Africa, thus raising a question of moral and human issues which contains the gravest implications for the future peace and progress of the world, she continued. In fighting for those who share this denial of human rights and who suffer under foreign control, India stands for equality between peoples and for the independence of all colonial areas. We believe that an enduring peace cannot be achieved so long as there is discrimination against one race by another. The Indian case in South Africa becomes, therefore, a test case not only on the question of human rights, but also for the purposes of the principles of the Charter itself, she concluded. Now, just sort of a parenthetical context here, what's going on. In South Africa, Jan Smuts is the head of the government, and they have passed something called the Ghetto Act, and the Ghetto Act basically marginalizes people of Indian descent in South Africa and treats them as second-class citizens. This is a domestic law in South Africa, but because the United Nations, which Smuts had championed, now exists, India is trying to make the case that what they're doing in South Africa to people of Indian descent violates the Charter. Now, this is complicated, of course, because we're talking about what's going on inside of South Africa by its own domestic law. So that's the principle that's at stake. Later, Nan was the featured speaker at a mass meeting of the NAACP at a jazz club in Harlem. 1,000 people were in attendance. Walter White, the NAACP secretary, introduced her as one of the two greatest women in the world, along with Eleanor Roosevelt. The separation of the peoples of the world through suspicion and hatred, a condition far worse than war, now threatened peaceful human coexistence, Nan declared. She called for action to match the beautiful words now being heard at the United Nations. There's only one problem in the world today of which all others are merely a part, she said. The name of that problem is the denial of justice. People are being told that they must wait for one thing or another because of the many problems that must be solved first. But they cannot wait. The time has come when the colored peoples of the world must stand up and claim what is our own. The plenary session of the General Assembly was scheduled for the evening of the 7th of December in Flushing Meadows. At last, it was time. Jan Smuts, the head of South Africa, came to the podium and defended his country, charging that it would be monstrous for the UN to condemn a member state. He expressed sympathy with the Indian position, but resolutely stuck to his claim that there were thorny legal questions involved and that the matter thus had to be sent to the International Court of Justice for adjudication. When he was finished, former Solicitor General of the United States, Charles Fahey, leapt up to endorse the South African position, saying that it was eminently proper for the world court to weigh in. Charles Fahey is one of the world's great lawyers at this point. Then Nan, elegant and commanding in a black silk sari, strode down the aisle and onto the stage. It is too late now to argue that the fundamental violations of the Charter are matters of domestic jurisdiction of member states, she began. If this was the case, the Charter would be a dead letter, and our professions about a world free from inequalities of race, free from want, and free from fear are empty mockery. Those, by the way, are the four freedoms. I want to carry the Assembly with me in these matters, which, I submit, are common ground. We are trustees of the future, architects of a new world. If we continue to act in accordance with old prejudices and old conceptions, which we have so often condemned, we shall betray the trust reposed in us by millions of voiceless people who, because of their creed or color, have been relegated to positions of inferiority and are looking up to us for justice. And it is only on the foundation of justice that we can erect a new world order. We have given much thought to the problem arising from the invention of the atom bomb, which threatens the future of mankind, and yet we forget that forces generated by maladjustments of human relations are perhaps equally powerful and an equal threat to the future of the world. Forces and feelings which move the minds of men are often more far-reaching in their effects than material forces. We must create for the United Nations the abounding confidence of the common people in it as the defender of justice, public law, and morality. This is what I ask you to do. She had spoken for about 15 minutes. As she turned to make her way back to her seat, the Assembly roared its approval with loud and prolonged applause, and one of the warmest ovations ever accorded a speaker at any of the international organization's sessions. All sound went out of the room as the votes started to roll in around 2 a.m., as everyone held their breath. But the verdict was soon clear. The Indians had triumphed. Nayanthara, now Nayanthara is Vijayalakshmi Pandit's second daughter, her middle daughter of three, and is today one of India's most illustrious writers. But at the time, she's just a student in the United States, a student at Wellesley. Nayanthara leapt up from her chair and ran over to her mother, who was still seated at the delegation table. She gave her a joyful kiss, which suddenly could be heard in the entire chamber as it was picked up by Nan's live microphone. It was just the spark the crowd needed. The hall broke out into tremendous applause. People from all over the room swarmed forward to congratulate Madam Pundit on her great hard-won victory over racial discrimination. Emotional delegates started crying for joy, jumping on desks and embracing one another. Heaton Nichols, the lead advocate for South Africa, looked on glumly from his seat as admirers followed Nan into the lounge next door. Nayanthara covered her mother in kisses again. The black press and race justice activists savored the defeat dealt to white supremacy. The New York Amsterdam News wondered on its front page how South Africa would save themselves from isolation in one world now that they had been handed such a humiliating setback. The paper noted that all comers, even the deceptive and hypocritical Sir Hartley Shawcross and Charles Fahey, were no match for the brilliant and silver-tongued oratory of Vijayalakshmi Pundit. Now, parenthetically here, let me just say very quickly, I already mentioned Charles Fahey. Sir Hartley Shawcross achieves renown as Britain's lead prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials. So Sir Hartley and Charles Fahey are two of the greatest lawyers in the whole world. Vijayalakshmi Pundit does not have a formal education. She's trained by tutors at home, and then she's trained by self-reading. She's sort of self-taught thereafter. She reads a lot, and through engagement with her brother, her family, and the things she does. This is quite an astonishing achievement in every regard, although she's renowned for her ability to speak and debate and all of these things. So it puts an end to some of the notions of, what privilege means. The paper called the victory won for our side in an editorial evocatively writing that racial Jim Crow had been blasted as out of line. They celebrated the stand that the diminutive and charming Indian delegate, who they noted had broadly identified herself with the struggle of all colored peoples against discrimination, had taken against the full battery of American arrogance, English chicancery, and their bootlicking stooges. It now remains for us, they wrote, and for all who believe in one world, to work that first step out to its fuller conclusion of justice for all men everywhere. The Atlanta Daily World headlined a front-page story, "Madam Pundit Leads Fight for Minorities," and noted that she was also urging Negro unity for independence. Writing in the Chicago Defender, W.E.B. Du Bois, America's greatest African-American intellectual, declared that every Negro organization in the United States ought to send an official note of thanks to Madam Vijayalakshmi Pandit, adding that she should be known to all persons of African descent as the leader of the successful assault upon the color line. He observed that she had not confined her attack to the Indian problem, but rather that she repeatedly spoke of the situation of the natives and the disabilities under which they labor. He praised her for her unselfish and courageous attitude and wrote that he hoped that it would spur solidarity and a more united front against racial injustice everywhere moving forward. That's the end of moment two. The result of Vijayalakshmi Pandit's actions were of enduring consequence, for it is this moment that established the precedent that state sovereignty was not and could not be impregnable. No state could hide behind the principle of domestic jurisdiction to violate principles of human dignity and equality. And thus it was this moment that established the precedent of international human rights, norms, and laws, as UN Assistant Secretary General Henri Laugier noted when he opened the Human Rights Commission several weeks later. And Vijayalakshmi Pandit herself was clear from the outset, building on her work that I talked about earlier in the first moment, that this was her intent. For our final moment, let's pick up on one thread from Pandit's South Africa speech, her comment about atomic weapons, which perhaps remains more pertinent than ever these days. Bertrand Russell was growing increasingly worried about the safety of the planet, fearing the true cost of nuclear war. As part of the Parliamentary Group for World Government, in Great Britain we're talking about, he helped devise a plan to safeguard everyone's future. In its first incarnation, broadcast a year before 1954, he had sketched out an idea for neutral nations to draw up a fair-minded assessment of the effects of atomic warfare. By the top of 1955, he told the House of Commons with much enthusiasm that he had concluded that the best path forward was simply to invite India alone to make the assessment, since the Indian Prime Minister had already laid out a similar vision in 1954 as well. He had already discussed the matter with both Nan and Nehru when the latter had been in London for the Commonwealth Conference. In February, just 5 days after an official announcement that Britain would take steps to develop hydrogen weapons, this was, if you saw the movie Oppenheimer, they call this the super. This is the issue of what they were, that was what the big thing that they were worried about. So now they have them, the super, the hydrogen weapons. A delegation came to see Nan to take their case forward. Their original plan was to send a large and representative deputation to speak with her, but in the end they decided on a much smaller group. They submitted a proposal and asked for approval to launch an educational campaign around the matter. She consulted with her brother, and he indicated that he indeed planned to do something about this soon, though he wanted no publicity about it. Dag Hammarskjöld, legendary Secretary General of the United Nations, had in the meantime convened a panel of nuclear scientists as well to lay the groundwork for an international atomic energy conference to be held later in 1955 in Geneva, the evolution of the proposal made by President Eisenhower in late 1953. That's Adams for Peace, and Vijayalakshmi Pandit presided over that famous talk as well. Adams for Peace, I mean. Eisenhower's talk. By the end of the follow-up UN discussion, Homi Bhabha, India's preeminent expert in the field, was asked to lead the Swiss event as president. Nehru brought Russell's idea, a variation of his own, before his cabinet and received authorization to go ahead. Nehru then discussed the matter with Bhabha, who endorsed the concept in principle, but thought that the international conference he was heading might be directly relevant. Nehru ultimately created a private commission to look into the atomic question without any fanfare. Russell, in the meantime, was pursuing a separate track, reaching out to Albert Einstein to see if prominent scientists could put out a statement warning against the dangers posed by super-destructive arms and urging the peaceful resolution of all conflicts. Einstein signed on to the Russell Declaration just before he died in 1955, making it the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, which was released in the middle of the summer, with additional signatories that included Linus Pauling, Max Born, Joseph Rotblat, and Hermann Muller. A few months later, the Nobel Prize-winning nuclear scientist Arthur Compton, who was the chair of the Organization for World Brotherhood, an outgrowth of the U.S. National Conference of Christians and Jews, with which Nan had previously been associated, announced that several high-powered figures would be joining his group to help take it forward. These figures included Konrad Adenauer, West German Chancellor, Paul Henry Spaak, the Belgian Foreign Minister, Carlos Romulo, the Philippine Ambassador to the United States, and Vijayalakshmi Pandit. And all of these people were named the new co-chairs of the organization, dedicated to fostering friendship, mutual respect, and cooperation among people of different religions, races, countries, and cultures. That April, Nan published an essay in Foreign Affairs in which she linked India's foreign policy to the project of peace, promoting coexistence over fear, and poetically claiming that her country's objective was to hold a hand uplifted over hate. Vijayalakshmi Pandit, we can conclude, that's the end of moment three. Vijayalakshmi Pandit, we can conclude, made critical contributions to the post-war order in theory and practice, sometimes in direct ways and other times in complementary fashion. She not only helped develop India's core foreign policy objectives in conjunction with other women, she also helped establish one of the key principles of the international in the modern world, that the international community has a role to play in ensuring the basic protection of people everywhere. Her abilities helped her triumph over the world's greatest legal minds, and her achievements and overall consistency of position made her the leader of choice for the world's most distinguished scientists and philosophers. After independence, Vijayalakshmi Pandit served as an official representative of her government, and her speeches and actions were intertwined with state policy, save, as I noted near the outset, for one exception. This was when she served as president of the UN General Assembly. Then she specifically distanced herself from her country and her government, saying that her new role was special. She now had to represent all people. This was a chance for her to be her true self, which, as she described it in her own words, was, and I quote, a citizen of the world. Thank you.
Thank you much for a wonderful reading and excellent research. The overwhelming question that I'm left with is, why was she sidelined?
It's like I couldn't script this any better. That's great. Thank you for asking that question. So the thing that I left out, but this is why, because it's fun to do this now. Okay. So she was one of the world's most famous women and celebrated multiple times as, I mean, she was in the U.S. We have a Gallup poll for most admired women in the world, and she was on that list repeatedly for a decade. And the top, I think her highest position was number three or something like that, but that's pretty high. I mean, you know, it's quite astonishing. And it was repeated. I told you Marlon Brando and all this. So she is one of these people. She's named First Lady of the World, one of the greatest women in the world, as I cited from Walter White and all these titles. So what happened? Where'd she go? Why doesn't anybody know who she is? Well, what happened is this. So after her brother died, there was some confusion as to what would follow, and somebody else became the prime minister. Vijayalakshmi Pandit continued in the government, but during the transition, Nehru's daughter, who all of us know as Indira Gandhi, started to become involved in politics. And the press made a lot of her involvement and pitched her as a foe to Vijayalakshmi Pandit, in opposition, that they were, you know, challenging one another. Now, this was not true, in fact. Let me parenthetically, before I go further, just say something very quickly. So there's a common understanding, but in fact misunderstanding, of this relationship. And today in India, it's commonly understood that Indira Gandhi always hated Vijayalakshmi Pandit, who was her aunt, and that they had a terrible relationship their whole life, and it stems from right when Indira Gandhi was a little girl, when Vijayalakshmi Pandit once told her that she was neither beautiful nor smart, in Hindi, of course, but this is a translation. And I mean, this is the kind of thing that if you're having a tea at a stall on a street, the vendor will recite this story. Everybody knows this story. Everybody up and down the whole country knows this story and believes that to be true. They're all wrong, but that's how well-versed it is. Now, why do people believe that? So I'm going to explain that at the end of the story, okay? But people believe that. Let's just start there. In fact, though, they had a very close relationship. Indira Gandhi basically was best friends with Vijayalakshmi Pandit's daughters. They spent a lot of time together. There's lots of letters back and forth of affection and non-worried about her incessantly. Now, does that mean she didn't once say something somewhere? And there were issues with Indira Gandhi's mother about how she was treated. There are some elements of truth to all of that. Those things kind of became magnified later. But in general, this is all very minimal, and they had a very good relationship. What happens is that through a series of circumstances, Indira Gandhi becomes the prime minister. And once she becomes the prime minister, all of those stories that had been circulating about her aunt wanting this or that or whatever, which was really press manipulation, the speculation, ate at Indira Gandhi's mind. Now, Indira Gandhi turned out to be an extremely capable politician, a very forceful personality, someone with a clear vision for whatever she wanted to accomplish, but she suffered from a number of shortcomings, and some of those included the fact that she was paranoid. And she was thin-skinned. And so these rumors that were circulating got her to be afraid that some of them were true. So finally, the relationship starts to become brittle, and Vijayalakshmi Pandit has no idea why. I mean, there's letter after letter where she's writing about this. It's very detailed. She's like, I don't know what's going on. You know, like, she still has affection for her. So it's a one-way street, whatever is happening. And so she goes to a meeting with Indira Gandhi, and she's supposed to be an ambassador to something or other again. And Indira Gandhi says, no, I'm not going to do this. And she goes, why? What's going on? She goes, well, Puppi is what she calls her, what means aunt, affectionate. I don't trust you. And so Vijayalakshmi Pandit is very happy. She's like, well, at least it's out in the open. Thank you for saying that. She goes and gives her a kiss, and they leave. Vijayalakshmi Pandit retires. Okay, that's not why she's not known. So she retires, and she sort of focuses on her children, and her daughter Nayanthara starts to become a writer and is traveling around the world. Well, what happens is this. In 1975, Indira Gandhi declares an emergency, suspending democracy in India and abrogating the Indian constitution. And when she does this, Vijayalakshmi Pandit is traveling abroad. She comes back to realize that the emergency has gone into effect, and she is placed under house arrest. Nayanthara remains in the United States. So house arrest means what? It means that she's confined to her house, and spies surround the house and are like recording. So she knows that this is going on. She actually kind of catches them. She sees them, and she kind of invites them in for tea, the spies. But whatever, she's out of commission. Now, the emergency, I don't want to bore you all, but this is a period of authoritarian rule in India. Democracy is under threat. The constitution has been suspended. All civil liberties are suspended. And terrible things happen in the country as the government, for example, sends vans around to forcibly pick up men and sterilize them, among other things. Among other things. I mean, many terrible things happen under the emergency. For a year or so, Vijayalakshmi Pandit is sort of stalled in her house. And then, basically, Nayanthara writes one column using a pseudonym called Azad, which means free, and says, in the United States, something is wrong in India. This is very important because Vijayalakshmi Pandit is super well known in the United States. She's beloved, and people over here still think of her as one of the greatest women in the world, and most important. And Indira Gandhi herself has many friends here, like Dorothy Norman, who's a famous photographer and writer. So the point is that Vijayalakshmi Pandit, in India's hour of need, comes out of retirement, sparked by this op-ed, and roars back to life and delivers an interview to the New York Times, blasting her niece, saying that she's destroyed democracy and the ideals that her brother and all of that generation had fought for, and therefore Vijayalakshmi Pandit was going to lead the charge against her niece to restore democracy. This also is a kind of not properly told story, but she then joins forces with a number of other folks, and it's a sort of broad union of opposition, and she's recognized as the VIP campaigner. I mean, it's publicly commented that she's the star. And so through her leadership, as well as those of others working there, they succeed. Indira Gandhi calls off the emergency in 1977, declares elections, and the United Opposition then campaign against her, and they win, defeating her at the ballot box and forcing an end to the emergency, restoring democracy. That's a great ending. Democracy is saved. But Indira Gandhi returns to power in 1980, reelected, because the opposition is not able to sort of stay together. And she never forgives her aunt for all that. By the way, when she lost, Vijayalakshmi Pandit went to her personally and said, you know, this isn't personal. You had gone astray. It was my duty to stop you because you were betraying these ideals, but I still love you, and gave her a kiss, the whole thing. But Indira Gandhi never forgave her aunt. And when she returned to power, she went about erasing her, literally, from the record, the public record. And nowhere is this more apparent than in this great house called Anand Bhavan, the city of joy, I mean, sorry, the abode of joy. City of Joy is a movie. In the Anand Bhavan, where they grew up, Vijayalakshmi Pandit and her brother, and it for 100 years, from 1900, well, it wasn't 100 years, but whatever, 70-odd years, it had stood as like this big, important building, and there was a lot of history that had gone on. If you go, it's a museum. If you go, there's like no record of her anywhere, of Vijayalakshmi Pandit. Why not? Because Indira Gandhi made sure that she was scrubbed, because Indira Gandhi took over control of that house. So that's why no one knows. Yeah, well, the book, I think, might be changing things, but... Yeah.
So I think I'm kind of the target audience for a book in a sense, because I grew up in India and, you know, I wish that I had heard more about her. And it's just so fascinating to hear so many things. So I have a comment and I have a question. My question is that what happened to the, All India Women's Conference?
Mm-hmm.
Conference, sorry. Yeah, so what happened to it after they wrote, they seem to have been very active. And then what happened?
It still exists.
Yeah.
And the person in charge of it just came to my book launch in Delhi. And they're still active, still going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have not heard about it, so I was just amazed by the letter that they wrote. And I wanted to just comment that, you know, that why she forgotten, and I do appreciate your personal side of it. But also it seemed to me that maybe, and I grew up when Indira Gandhi was making herself when she imposed the emergency and so on outside at the time, But it seemed that she really wanted power and she really would do anything to get political power. And maybe that was not what Vijayalakshmi Pandit really wanted, that she didn't.
Who wanted power? Indira Gandhi wanted power.
Yes, yeah. So that's what it seems like. And, you know, Vijayalakshmi Pandit, from what you're saying, because I have not heard otherwise, until now, was clearly so brilliant. And, you know, and she had so many opinions. But I don't know if people kind of, she was so much in the shadow of Nehru, because we heard so much about Nehru. He was very charismatic. And, you know, what he said as the philosophy of India, what it should be. And, you know, we heard so many things about him. So I wonder whether that was kind of, maybe she was known more outside India than she was inside. I don't know. She seems very comfortable in moving with, you know, a lot of high profile figures. But I don't know what is the enduring legacy, because it's not kind of come out into, for instance, I didn't know about this, the women's conference, you know. I didn't know they had written these things and they'd taken the stand. It didn't percolate into the common culture, even by word of mouth. Like, for instance, if they had groups within every college, I went to a women's college, so that would have been the perfect place to have, like, a college group. So I feel that maybe she was kind of kept in the shadow of him, and also maybe she didn't want that that brutal fights to kind of get that power and to have some kind of a mass movement, if you will.
Okay, so there's a lot there in that comment. Let me respond to a couple of different things. First of all, let me make clear that while she was alive and at the peak of her career, she was very well known in India. She ran for different positions by election many times and won. She also stood for Nehru's seat once he was dead and won. And she won overwhelmingly. She also began her career. She was the first woman cabinet minister in the British Empire to hold serious portfolios. And the first woman cabinet minister in India, for sure. But then there were a few other women who held cabinet posts before her within the British Empire, but her portfolios were the first serious ones. And she did many things in India. One of the biggest things that she did, for example, was, famously, there was a famine, the Bengal famine, and she is the one who led the efforts against the Bengal famine, raised awareness for that in India and abroad, and achieved acclaim for her work. I mean, it was not something she was seeking, because she was basically worried about dead children. And so she was trying to do her best to address that situation, but she did receive plenty of acclaim for that. She also went to prison multiple times for the various kinds of things. Anyway, all of that is talked about in the book, and of course, standing at the end against her niece was another big thing that she did, save democracy in the country. So she definitely had a domestic profile. And during her day, she received bazillions of accolades, not from Nehru, not caused by Nehru, not because Nehru sat and secretly pushed her name here and there. In fact, if anything, Nehru kind of got in her way, because he didn't want her... He was very cautious about... despite how he's characterized today, about being perceived as nepotistic. So what people don't know, for example, well, there were many positions she didn't get or take, one of which was Secretary General of the United Nations, which she was up for that as well. And the other is President of India, that was what people wanted and what she was up for. And Nehru made sure that did not happen, because he thought that would be terrible for her to be president and for him to be prime minister. So he kept that from happening. I wouldn't fault him for that call, but it's sort of an unfortunate situation, because it was something where she definitely had all those abilities. As far as Indira Gandhi's ruthless quest for power, I can't say that that's historically accurate in terms of her immediate, like how she became the prime minister, because we know that it I don't want to lose people. It's complicated, but there was a group of non-Hindi speaking politicians known as the Syndicate. They needed to put a face forward. They thought she would be the perfect face because she was very mousy. She had a sort of high, squeaky voice. She kind of was a wallflower. They didn't think she was really all that. They put her forward, made a huge mistake, and she destroyed them. So she wasn't really seeking it in that sense. On the other hand, was she ambitious? Sure. But this is one area where, I mean, I have plenty of criticism of Indira Gandhi, but this is one area where when women are ambitious, they're labeled manipulative and, you know, this and that and whatever. When men are ambitious, it's a sign of great things. So she was ambitious, so what? Vijayalakshmi Pandit herself was ambitious. So anyway, I would say those things. And then lastly, in terms of why she isn't so well known, you know, why you didn't hear of her and all this and the personal reasons. Here I'd say there's more to my answer. I didn't want to kind of complicate things. This is the primary answer, Indira Gandhi. But there is another, which is the more obvious one. The more obvious one is that she's a woman. And many of the things that she accomplishes, while it was amazing and legendary in her time, as people write those narratives, just as with the picture, she's just iced out of the story. Just cut right out. Who is she? What did she do? What, you know? And you don't have to go very far to know that what I'm saying is correct. You know, somebody asked me in an interview, you know, don't you think she hasn't received as much attention as Sarojini Naidu and Kasturba Gandhi? For those of you in the room, Sarojini Naidu was known as the Nightingale of India and one of the great sort of poets and writers of the country, legendary person. And Kasturba Gandhi was Gandhi's wife. Nobody knows anything about these two women. They're two of the most important legendary figures in the country. If I ask anyone to name me five things about them, nobody can, other than what I just said. Ooh, the Nightingale of India. She's a famous poet. She's a this. That's it. Nobody knows anything else. And why not? Because, of course, they're marginalized. They're not considered to be the main architects of the country. All you have to do is pick up any book. Architects of Modern India. Who are they? Nehru, Gandhi, Ambedkar, a whole bunch of men. And the women are often excised or put as a footnote. And so I think these are some of the elements that are involved here. It's layers upon layers. There's another part, one other part to the story. Sorry, one last thing. I don't want to get into this right now unless someone wants me to. She faced a nemesis in her day. So she wasn't just, it wasn't all successes all the way to the end. She had her, shall we call him, her bete noire. And that was a man named V.K. Krishna Menon. Krishna Menon led India's delegation to the United Nations after a point. And then eventually he becomes India's defense minister. And he hated her. He did hate her for a period of time. He was brilliant, and he loved Nehru. And they had some kind of weird relationship that Nehru couldn't get out of. It was like some kind of hypnosis that he was under Krishna Menon's spell, like a Rasputin, almost. Menon iced her out while she was alive. She eventually triumphs over Menon, but for a good period of time, while she's still at the peak of her fame and her powers, she suddenly no longer has her brother's ear and is no longer listened to. And we can tell two things from this fact. I said I wasn't going to do it, I'm doing it anyway. One is, how important was she? Well, we know how important she was. You know how we know? Because the minute she's iced out, there's many disasters that occur in Indian foreign policy. They're all caused by her absence. As long as she was there and counseling, and her counsel was heeded, they were basically on the right track. Doesn't mean she was always perfect. She made mistakes also, but she managed to sort of be a little bit more prudent in her judgment. Menon was kind of proud of being way more out there, and when you're way more out there, you risk greater consequences. So that's the story. Any other questions? Yes,
well, thank you. It's wonderful research. Great talk.
Thank you.
Before I go, 2024 tangential question here about women leadership and all this. Can we get your perspective on Kamala Harris?
Well, I'm what to say? First of all, Kamala Harris's full name is Kamala Devi Harris. And there's a famous Indian woman who visited the United States on a tour. Vijayalakshmi Pandit did a tour as well and achieved a lot of fame for it. I didn't get into any of this. This is before she comes in official pose. But at around the same time, another woman who is featured in the book because they knew one another was also in the United States. Her name is Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay. And she is an influential activist and intellectual and a politician in India as well. But she's very influential in the United States. Do you know how I know that? Because Gloria Steinem, who I had the great privilege of having endorsed my book, Gloria Steinem, one of the famous leaders of the 1960s wave of feminism in the U.S., will happily tell you about how she feels her inspiration and therefore the inspiration for the movement in the U.S. is her encounter with Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay and the kinds of conversations and things that she learned from her. I've separately written a little bit about Kamala Devi. I have a friend named Nico Slate who teaches at Carnegie Mellon, and he's just published her biography, if anyone is interested, on Kamala Devi. At any rate, so Kamala Devi Harris is, we don't have any definitive certainty, but there's a high correlation between the name Kamala Devi and Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay, who is a well-known figure. It doesn't necessarily mean that's what she's named after, but at the very least, there's resonance. Let's put it that way. There's resonance. What do I have to say about her? I'll put it this way. In 2016, I wrote an essay on the rise of global authoritarianism and the threat that it posed to democracy around the world and to global stability. And that essay went viral internationally. It was republished in Germany as the lead article in one of the major parties' major magazines. And the basis of that piece was that I noticed at the time of the rise of Donald Trump in the United States similarities between his rise and the rise of other figures around the world who were similar. So in that piece, I talked about what could be causing this thing. And I subsequently have written about this many, many, many times at people's requests and talked about it in multiple interviews. I don't want to bore you with the details of it, but in short, the explanation is that the original cause, which set all this off, was triple forces of globalization: the globalization of the economy, the globalization of conflict, and the globalization of crises. The economy basically meant that global corporate structures had evolved, were evolving from the 70s forward for various reasons, beyond the scope of any one state or government to regulate them. They existed in transnational form, and therefore no government could properly regulate these entities any longer. The result was that they could get away with and do various kinds of things, global corporatism, and therefore this takes away power from people at the local level and the ability of democracy, any democracy, to respond. I've got a problem, I go to my official, I can't do anything because this thing sort of is beyond us in scope. So we can only target whatever little thing is here, but they have other mechanisms that if we do something, they might threaten to do something else. So that's one thing. The globalization of conflict at the time that I wrote that had to do with the long war on terror. Basically, the idea was that people didn't feel safe wherever they were, whether they were a civilian or in combat. This insecurity was a problem. So this is physical insecurity combined with economic insecurity. You'll see this kind of language used by many people today, kind of now a little bit more critically. because there are other reasons, but at the time, economic insecurity and physical insecurity were what I saw as the basis. And then the last one, the globalization of crises, and at the time I was talking about something that now seems so mundane, but I was talking about things like Zika and Ebola, and I talked about the devastating possibility of wide-scale viral disease and the way that it was threatened. This 2016. And of course, and I, in, combined with that with climate change. Well, you know, obviously now we've had COVID, so the point is proven beyond any doubt now. So those things basically led to this tremendous amount of insecurity and an urgency for people to feel like something was being done. Democracies, by definition, are not things that can respond quickly like that. They're deliberative, and they're deliberative. They can act quickly in an emergency, but these were things that were hard to pitch as emergencies because there were you know, sort of longer histories involved with them. And so the result was that in place after place after place, people were coming up through democracies to say, through the democratic system, to say, we need a strong leader who can take us back, we can be great again, blah, blah, blah. The language is the same, repeatedly, repeatedly, repeatedly all over. So these strong men promised this stuff, authoritarian rule, and this return to some kind of like nationalistic purpose. But in all of these cases, their prescription is wrong because the problem, in fact, all three problems are international in scope. The problem is not domestic, the problem is not national, the problem is international. The problems are international. And therefore, only something international is going to be able to address them, which means what we're really talking about is addressing the problem of the international order and how you kind of figure something out at that scale. In order to do that, you must be talking about things through a democratic system, otherwise we wind up in the realm of tyranny. If you have any kind of international order without democracy, well, that's the old imperial order. And that's where we are. We're at a pitched battle between the forces of the old imperial vision and ones that are thinking about a new international system, even if that international system is a series of interconnected democracies to build, and other states as well, but moving towards a greater democratic system. So I would say that that is my answer, in which I would contextualize what is happening right now. I feel like in my official position at work and in my position here, I should be cautious about saying something specific in the context of an election. But what I would say is that I'm a partisan for democracy, and that if there is a threat to democracy, I think people should oppose it. Because if the system itself is under threat, then you know, what use is disagreement over a policy? It's fine to disagree over policy. That's the purpose of debate, deliberation within a democratic system. If the point is to destroy that system, then that must be opposed, I think, by all clearly thinking people. Anything else? Yeah?
Just one last question. Could you go through a little bit about the research of the book? What was the most difficult part of getting it all done from the process?
So the book, well, she was a figure in my last book, and when I got asked to do this, I stupidly thought, oh, I know the story. How long can it take me? I'll pull a few more things, and then, you know, a year. Well, anyway, it took me 8 years. I think seven countries, I've forgotten now. I think it's seven countries. I know, it's whatever I wrote. Seven countries, I think, 40 archives. Five languages. And the challenge is that in some of her records, things are a little unclear. There's ambiguity. Some things are not quite true. This is true in all the records. So how do you figure that out? So you have to kind of track down and see if you can corroborate that elsewhere, and if you can, then that's good. And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. And So to answer your question, the hardest part of research is to figure out how to deal with this question of ambiguity. You want to, you know, as a historian or as a storyteller, you want everything to be perfect. But let me ask you all a simple question. If I ask you to close your eyes and think about something that you did, you yourself did, yesterday, earlier today, in the last week, where you snapped at someone you care for, you fought with a relative or a parent, you, I don't know, whatever, you something, and you have no, why did you do that? Or you don't have, it doesn't have to be in the last week. If you just think back, have you ever done something where you're like, why did I do that? We all have that moment, right? Where we don't have any explanation for ourselves. We don't know what we're doing. We sort of, sometimes something comes out of our mouth. Just in everyday conversations, something comes out of our mouth and the little voice in our head says, why did you say that? Oh, I wish I could take that back. Oh, I can't. So now I gotta. So the point is life is full of ambiguity. How well do we know ourselves? Oftentimes we don't know ourselves very well. That's why we're sometimes shocked when other people have juxtaposing opinions about us than what we think of ourselves. And so when you're writing a biography, part of the difficult task, the most difficult answer, most difficult part to answer your question, Anthony, is figuring out where you clarify something through corroboration and record and written response and all that, and where you leave the ambiguity in. If I didn't leave the ambiguity in, she wouldn't be a whole person. It wouldn't be a realistic portrait. We don't know all the answers. We can't know all the answers because she didn't know all answers about herself. None of us do. So that thing about ambiguity, I'd say, is that's the big challenge. I might say one last thing just as a way of ending, if that's okay, because it's part of this answer. The other thing is that I talked about how great she was, and she was great. And I hope you walk away from here thinking, wow, what an extraordinary woman of accomplishment, not just a woman, extraordinary person, who broke all these barriers and so forth. But at the same time, she was someone who also struggled with mental health issues multiple times. She had to check into clinics. She traveled around the world to get proper care. She had multiple breakdowns. And she also had some physical health issues that needed care. I made sure to put all of that in the book. And this struck people in India. They were like, why are you doing that? Why would you put this in there? And they asked me about it in interviews. And the answer is very simple, to me anyway. The answer is that it was really important for me for that stuff to be in the book. Why is that? Well, mental health is often, mental health, physical health, is something that many people have. Most people have, actually. And it's not something that's always constant. It can come and go. And it's often stigmatized as something we shouldn't talk about. People should hide, or it's personal, or something like this. And when that happens, it's very isolating. And people don't get the treatment that they need, or the help that they need, or they don't get a chance to feel like what they're going through is normal. And it is entirely normal. It is entirely normal and very, very, very common. So it's very important for me to put that in the book so that I hope that readers feel seen wherever they are in their needs by this person of extraordinary achievement, to see that just how normal it is and that it's totally fine to have those things. We all need help. We all need to ask for help sometimes. And one that does not stop one from great achievements. I'll end it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to Professor Bhagavan for a wonderful presentation. You can purchase the book online from Amazon. The link is available on tonight's talk webpage. And with that, enjoy the rest of your Friday evening. Happy holidays to those of you who are celebrating this current week. And we look forward to seeing you soon at our other upcoming events. Thank you very much.